the headlines this hour. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says Iran will pursue its nuclear rights despite threats. In Iraq, the main Shia blocs join hands to form a new coalition government. And NATO says the Taliban still dominate parts of Afghanistan after years of war. Hello everyone and welcome to the news here on Press TV. Our top story this hour, Iran's president says his country will not bow to pressure and illegal demands. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said the efforts of some nuclear weapon countries to prevent Iran's peaceful nuclear program are against the non-proliferation treaty and international law. Speaking to ABC News, Ahmadinejad said states possessing nukes should have been denuclearized under the treaty. He also criticized U.S. double standards regarding nuclear technology. The president reiterated political pressure cannot prevent Iran from enriching uranium. He condemned the U.S. Secretary of State's call for new U.N. sanctions against Iran. He said such remarks violate the rights of the Iranian nation. He said the ties between Iran and the U.S. will never improve if a fourth round of sanctions is imposed on Iran. Well, President Ahmadinejad had a press conference earlier today. We're now joined live on the line by Press TV's correspondent in New York, Afaf Khanja, to tell us more about the Iranian president's press conference there. Afaf, what was the main theme of Mr. Ahmadinejad's press conference? What did he say?
I think the main theme was that President Ahmadinejad was basically speaking to the international community and saying that that the U.S., for example, should really allow non-nuclear states to enjoy the production of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. And he began his press conference by stating that the only way to have a better world and sustainable security with viable peace will be through cooperation based on principles, justice, compassion, and friendship. Those were his words. He was referring mainly again to Western powers, including the U.S., who, you know, of course, are currently proposing a draft resolution that, if passed, would place, in fact, a fourth round of sanctions on Iran. And as mentioned, the president said that if fresh sanctions were placed on Iran, the Iranian government would no longer be interested in any kind of relationship with the United States. Ahmadinejad referenced U.S. President Obama and his administration, noting that if President Obama really wants change, particularly a change in approach from the previous administration, and that, you know, he won't pressure, introduce political pressure to other allies to, of course, go further with these with the sanctioned regime, and that an opportunity was and is given to him during this NPT review conference here at the UN, when unfortunately U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton addressed the NPT review conference, and she specifically referred to Iran, saying that. That cynically claimed to be abiding by the treaty while violating its safeguards, expanding its enrichment program, failing to cooperate with the IAEA, and ignoring the injunctions of the Security Council. And on that, President Ahmadinejad said, "How is the U.S. and the P3+3 asking Iran to that Iran has the onus is on Iran, if you will, to disprove these allegations?" When the president said that basically Iran is using its nuclear program for peaceful purposes. So how can we disprove something that isn't, in fact, taking place? He also went further on to say that the NPT treaty on its three pillars, you know, non-proliferation, disarmament, and, of course, what's needed with weapon-free zones, specifically from the 1995 resolution for the Middle East, that it should be revised and that it should not be, coming from, you know, pressure, if you will, from Western powers who are nuclear, you know, some of the ones who are nuclear states to putting pressure on those non-nuclear states such as Iran. And Ahmadinejad, of course, criticized the U.S. government for waiting about 60 years, he said, to reveal publicly that it has over, what was said, 5,000 nuclear warheads. And he said another time that we were told that the U.S. has over 10,000 nuclear warheads. Another time it was over 30,000. His point being that it took them so long, it took the United States so long to make this public information public, whereas, for example, Iran, who's being pressured, you know, within the IAEA and the NPT treaty, etc., has always been has always shared their information as far as their nuclear program with the IAEA. He said, quote, the cameras were always open with our facilities, even the new ones for centrifugation. He says the IAEA is very well informed, and that Iran, of course, has you know, publicly provided the information and has been very cooperative. But his he was very, very succinct in his message. He was very clear that Iran is willing, ready, has always been willing and ready to negotiate, but he says that it has to be through logic, through reason, and, of course, through international cooperation.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Many thanks there to Press TV's Afaf Khanja reporting from New York about the recent press conference of the Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Many thanks there. Well, still with the United States, and the country has revealed the number of weapons it holds in its nuclear stockpile. Officials say the announcement by the U.S. is a move encouraging more transparency. But is this just a step in a new direction or just another political posturing? Press TV's Colin Campbell has tried to find the answer.
For the first time, the United States publicly disclosed the number of its nuclear weapons in front of a special U.N. conference on global nuclear nonproliferation. According to the Pentagon, the American nuclear arsenal consists of 5,113 warheads as of the end of September 2009. The number represents an 84% decrease from 1967, when the U.S. stockpile was at its largest, with 31,255 warheads. Previously, the numbers were considered highly classified.
That's an extraordinary step. I mean, this new data remakes the point, but it's been a point that's been true for quite a while.
In April, the U.S. and Russia signed a renewed strategic arms reduction treaty that would lower the numbers of deployed American and Russian nuclear weapons to their lowest levels since the 1950s.
The United States and Russia hold more than 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. The New START treaty replaces the old one, signed in 1991 before the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And that treaty expired in December 2009.
During the same conference, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad railed against the United States. Ahmadinejad criticized the U.S. for being the first to use nuclear weapons and blamed its policies for the threat of nuclear dangers worldwide. Critics say the U.S. is dismantling older nuclear warheads and replacing them with new ones. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the criticism is meant to distract the public. The U.S. is pushing for sanctions against Iran, but says it will lend support to other countries that it believes are following agreed-upon guidelines to prevent military rendering of nuclear material.
It's important to remember the real context in which this is happening, and this is all occurring against a backdrop of extraordinary reductions.
The release of nuclear data was weighed heavily by the White House and Pentagon, according to U.S. officials. Its purpose designed to put pressure of transparency on other countries in question over nuclear ambitions. For Press TV, Colin Campbell, Washington.
To Iraq now, where the main Shia political blocs have agreed on an alliance that could lead to the formation of the country's next coalition government. Well, that ends nearly 2 months of political wrangling in the country. Here's more.
An end seems to be near in Iraq's political stalemate nearly 2 months after Iraqis went to the polls in general elections. The country's two main Shia blocs have agreed to unite what many believe could help form the country's next coalition government. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's State of Law Coalition and the Iraqi National Alliance will now merge, commanding 159 seats in the country's 325-seat parliament. That's still 4 seats short of an absolute majority in the chamber, but President Jalal Talabani's Kurdistan Alliance has already said it would join the two factions in a future coalition government. No word yet on who will be chosen prime minister.
We are welcoming all Iraqis to be part of it, to nominate a prime minister from this coalition and abide by a very comprehensive government program which will focus a great deal of its part on the economy and improving Iraqis' daily life.
The Iraqi National Alliance is made up of the Sadr movement, led by Muqtada al-Sadr, the Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council, led by Ammar al-Hakim, and former Prime Minister Ibrahim Jafari's National Reform Movement. But why form a coalition?
The stakes are very high, and there is a huge threat from outside of Iraq and inside Iraq, internal Ba'athist and Saddam's forces helped by some Arab countries to overthrow this nascent democracy and replace it with the dictatorship.
Maliki's coalition won 89 seats in the March general elections, while the Iraqi National Alliance took 70. Former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's Sunni majority bloc won 91 seats. Alawi had warned that an alliance of the two major Shia blocs that attempted to exclude his coalition from government could result in a return to violence in Iraq.
Well, this is a very regrettable statement that he made. We are not going to exclude anyone. The only one we are going to exclude, the only people who are going, we're going to have a red line to deal with are the Ba'athists and the Saddamists.
The number of seats gained by each party could still change as votes in the key Baghdad constituency are being recounted. But major changes to Iraq's political makeup are not expected as the country moves toward healing the scars of 7 years of a U.S.-led war and occupation and decades of dictatorship.
Now, a top NATO official has acknowledged the Taliban's dominance in parts of southern Afghanistan. NATO's civilian representative in Afghanistan says foreign troops have faced strong resistance in and around the city of Kandahar. Mark Sedwell says he expects the summer offensive to intensify gradually in the militant strongholds. Sedwell said that efforts will be made to reinforce and improve security in Kandahar, which has been the main battleground since the U.S.-led invasion back in 2001. The escalating conflict in southern Afghanistan is taking an increasing toll on foreign troops there, as well as Afghan civilians. The U.S. and NATO have already been under fire from both the Afghan government and the public for civilian casualties. To tell us more about the situation in Afghanistan, we're joined on the phone from San Francisco by Richard Becker. He's with the ANSA Coalition. Welcome to the program, sir. Mr. Becker, the question is how the Taliban can still dominate parts of Afghanistan after 9 years of a U.S.-led war?
Well, thank you. It's really, I think, an outgrowth of the kind of war that is being fought there and of the occupation. You know, it's just 5 days ago that outside of Jalalabad in the eastern part of Afghanistan, a night raid by 100 NATO troops, at least 100 NATO troops, on the home of the relatives of a member of the Afghan parliament ended up killing her brother-in-law. Her name is Safia Siddiqui, and her brother-in-law was killed in this raid. And afterwards, hundreds of people, it was reported, took to the streets in the middle of the night in a demonstration chanting death to America. And, of course, this is what's been going on year after year after year. I think that just conceiving of what it's like to live under that kind of occupation, that kind of routine brutality, is really the explanation for why there is such widespread resistance to the continuation of the U.S.-NATO occupation of the country.
Now, what do you think the United States is seeking to achieve in Afghanistan at this point in time? It's been 9 years it's been there.
Yeah, and, you know, it's certainly not what they say they're trying to achieve, because all reports are that the reason the U.S. government gives is that they're rooting out al-Qaeda. But al-Qaeda exists in many, many countries now, and there's no apparent existence of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And so that can't be the reason that the war is going on. I think much more reasonable and understandable motivation is that is linked to the whole U.S. strategy in the region, which is one of domination, of wanting to control Afghanistan as it wants to control all of the countries in this key strategic region of the world, the Middle East and West Asia. The understanding that's being given to the people here, the propaganda, I would say, that is used to justify the war, has nothing whatsoever to do with the reality of what the imperial ambitions of the United States really are.
So, Mr. Becker, till when do you think the United States can continue with this trend?
Well, right now, the U.S. strategy is really one of wishing to be able to retain control, but also wanting very much, and this is, I think, also true in the latter stages, the more recent stages of the Iraq War, to not appear to be defeated And that's very critical for the empire, not to appear to be subject to defeat. But in fact, they are suffering defeats, and it was just a couple of weeks ago, perhaps less, that there was the announcement that the United States forces were pulling out of the Korangal Valley. They had been there for years. At least 46 U.S. troops had been killed. Hundreds had been wounded. There was no purpose in it except to use those soldiers, and I emphasize use them, as bait to try to draw out resistance forces so then air power could be used against them. Well, that's now ended, and a number of other bases like that have been closed down. And there's a great escalation in the number of troops, both from the United States and to a lesser degree from the other NATO countries. It'll be 150,000 soon in Afghanistan, probably another 100,000 contractors or private military forces. And they're trying to avert defeat and retain control of the country. But the strategy does not appear to have any kind of a clear perspective of achieving that.
All right, we'll leave it there. Many thanks to Richard Becker with the Anti-Coalition from San Francisco. Well, now, Scotland and Northern Ireland's airspace will be closed Wednesday after Iceland's already active volcano has again started eruptions. Britain's civil aviation authorities said the airports in the two countries are expected to be closed. It warned the volcano's ash will possibly affect northwest of England and North Wales airports in the coming days. The body will release more travel guidance later on Tuesday. This as the Europe's airspace was completely closed last month due to sand and ash from the same volcano. Here's more.
The volcanic ash cloud was back, just in time for the extraordinary European Council meeting. EU transport ministers arrived in Brussels with plenty of baggage from last month's air transport crisis, just to be greeted by reports of fresh new disruptions. Ireland closed its airports for several hours Tuesday morning as the ash cloud started drifting south.
This is going to continue to happen, and volcanoes, they don't obey any rule. We must do our utmost to ensure that millions of people and businesses never have to re-live this crisis.
The crisis cost airlines up to 2.5 billion euros and left millions stranded for days. To prevent this from happening again, officials said it would be crucial to speed up the creation of a single European airspace and a single regulator.
Setting up the European single sky is one of the main objectives of the Spanish government, as is shown in the Spanish presidency's document on its priorities. And unfortunately, this crisis has proved we are right in choosing that as a priority.
Another important issue, passenger rights. Early in the day, the network of European consumer centres, supported by the European Commission and operating in all EU member states, came up with a practical complaint package. It informs passengers affected by the crisis how to claim their consumer rights. But how effective would this be, given that few passengers are likely to go to court over several hundred euros? Should airlines fail to reimburse them? 2 days before the general elections in the United Kingdom, Conservative Party leader David Cameron decided to proceed with the scheduled trip to Northern Ireland despite the flight restrictions early in the day, saying, quote, "We're battling through everything to make this happen." Experts say flight disruptions will continue later this week and throughout the summer. This underscores the importance of revising the current response mechanism to react swiftly and in a more coordinated manner to crises affecting the mobility of EU citizens. Such an overhaul, however, will take months to complete. NMR Press TV, Brussels.
And you're watching the news here on Press TV. A quick check of the headlines this hour. President Ahmadinejad says Iran will pursue its nuclear rights despite threats. In Iraq, the main Shia blocs join hands to form a new coalition government. And NATO says the Taliban still dominates parts of Afghanistan after years of war.